I am now recording, so go ahead.
Okay. Welcome to the July 7th, 2020 session of TeamSpeak for, not TeamSpeak, Zoom for Tangerine SDR and Hamsai. This week, I've been doing some programming. I had a few days off and gotten involved at work. I became a book editor this week, so we're putting a special book together. So that's another task on top of everything else I do. So anyway, that's it for me. We'll start going down the list. So next on my list is Nathaniel. W2NAF, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Dave. This week I have been working with Rachel trying to figure out what we're going to do with the ash trees on our property. And I've also been spending a lot of time reading a paper by Larissa Goncharenko entitled Sudden Stratospheric Warming Impacts on the Ionosphere Thermosphere System, a Review of Recent Progress. It is a chapter from a book that is probably similar to what Dave is putting together, but from a different field. And I'm trying to understand better how the lower atmosphere impacts the ionosphere. I'm trying to imagine ways that we will sense that in the ham radio data, and what science questions can we answer with that. So,
yeah, very good. And next on the list, we have Mike, AA8K. Go ahead, Mike. Fine business. And thank you for volunteering to continue doing sound. Sound recordings. Next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. Well, I did a lot of putzing with Raspberry Pis this last week. Did a couple more tries at compiling things. Also installed Ubuntu 20.04 64-bit with Desktopify, which is kind of a desktop add-on that uses the 20 or the 64-bit 20.04 server version and kind of modifies it to be a desktop. And it works fairly well, a few issues, but nothing fatal. I did write a script to compile GNU Radio on that system. It went 96% of the way and died over missing a library. It's called it's actually a header file called kissfft.h. And I think that's the problem that's been around for a while. I'm kind of researching some ways to overcome that. I did find the header files online, and all I have to do now is figure out how to get them onto the system in a way that the system recognizes them as includes. And then I should be able to go ahead and compile things. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
I have a question for you. I've been trying to compile some things, both Lin HPSDR and I still am having troubles with GNU Radio on my regular Linux machine, but I did have the one thing that I was curious about. Well, maybe I'll talk about this later when we get to general discussion, since I said I'd be quick. I'll come back.
Okay.
Next, we have Veronica. Go ahead, Veronica.
Hello. This week, I fixed my graphs because I originally had the wrong dates in them. So I redid that and I fixed them. Then I've been, I put them into a presentation and I've been working on analyzing them to see what they show.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Bill. I can't remember his call sign off the top of my head. Go ahead, Bill.
AB4EJ, North Cornell, okay. Alabama.
There you go.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, as some folks may remember from last week, I discovered, which is something we already knew, but I proved it, that the red pitaya isn't precise enough for the Doppler analysis that we want to do. So I set about trying to learn how to use IQ data from the Flex radio. And it turns out it's non-trivial to do that, but I finally figured it out. It was tough enough that I packaged an explanation on how to do it and put it out on GitHub, because we had a discussion on Nathaniel's Thursday afternoon conference about this. But I discovered several things that turned out to be a very, very useful exercise. First of all, I got it working, so I can take a look at Doppler shift at the same level of precision that we can expect from the tangerine, or in that vicinity, getting down into the 20 sub 20 millihertz precision for the data. And I discovered that the Flex radio data adheres to a standard. There's apparently an international standard for SDR data called VITA 49. And I thought to myself, you know, we ought to make the tangerine compliant with VITA 49, which actually it's so close to what I designed anyway, because there's only so much you can do with SDR IQ data. So I'm going to put together a little thing on that. There is one area that in which the VITA 49 standard does not play well with digital RF in one specific way. Digital RF expects all the samples that you're taking, all the different sub-channels, to be presented all in one shot. And that's how it saves them, to make sure that you guarantee that all the samples are lined up exactly in time. The VITA 49 standard wants you to split different sub-channels into different streams. So anybody who's played with networks, especially when running UDP, you know that they're non-deterministic, and it is can be really a problem to try and line up samples so that you get all the same ones, because I did some timing experiments, actually timing how long it takes the buffers to travel. And you'd get a couple of them that were 10.6 milliseconds apart. Okay, 48,000 samples per second. But then there'd be one that was 200 milliseconds, and another one 5 milliseconds after that. And if you have a bunch of these coming in at different speeds, I would throw up my hands at trying to write code to line all that up, to put all channels together lined up in time like digital RF requires. So I thought we can have a couple of modes of operation for the tangerine. We can have a mode that's fully VITA 49 compliant. So people who would like to use the tangerine data engine with other types of SDR software, they'll be good to go. We could have another tangerine mode that states that it does the interleaving of sub-channel data like we've already designed, like already works like a champ. So will the VITA 49 people give us allow us to add something to their standard? I don't know. Yeah. But anyway, if we're going to support our side of it, it seems like we ought to be able to get away with it. But it did occur to me that if we go with a standard like this, it makes the tangerine accessible to a whole bunch of other pre-existing SDR software. And so that felt like a good discovery there that we can use.
Also, Bill, a quick question. I was on the understanding that the VITA 49 did not put any constraints on what occurs inside the data packet. So is it prohibited to interleave data, IQ data, in one VITA 49 packet?
I don't know that I would say that it is prohibited. It's except the way it works is each packet has a single stream ID in it.
Oh, okay. So no multiple stream IDs, so you can't put multiple streams in.
Bill?
Yeah.
I think, doesn't digital RF have both channels and sub-channels? So if you did channels instead of sub-channels, can you do them as separate streams?
It doesn't work that way to my knowledge.
Okay, because I remember when I was using the Red Pitayas, I set them up. I had the option of either streaming as channels or sub-channels. And I So I wonder if that is something to look into.
Well, I can look into it, but as of right now, I don't want to try and save multiple files that are all open at the same time and trying to write different, keep track of all that. I mean, we've got a schedule to hit to be ready.
That's the beauty of the format that we have, is we can do it the way you're doing it right now and call them a certain frame type. And then if we want to use Vita 49 with simple string longer, then we can do that.
Yeah, yep. I mean, I think we can make it. We can have two operating modes for the data engine. We can say full Vita 49 compliance, and then the tangerine flavor of Vita 49.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So can we finish this during the open discussion? Because we got three more people on the list, and I want to get through it before the end of the hour.
Just to add one more thing, I thought a lot about the continuous versus on-demand mode of spectrum uploading, and we can talk about that in the in our open chat session, because it seems to me like we've identified two different use cases for doing that each have an application. So we can go into that in more detail. Okay, back to you, Dave.
Okay, next on the list we have Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, everyone. Not too busy this week. I really enjoyed the HAMSCI call on Thursday. Thank you for setting that up, Nathaniel. I learned a lot and spent some time looking at spectral whitening filters and how those might be implemented in an FPGA. So good subject, good discussion. That's about it for the week.
Okay. Next on the list, we have Jonathan, KC3EEY. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. I basically have some questions, and perhaps they could be answered in the open discussion. But anyway, I've been thinking about clocking and how I would accomplish time stamping VLF audio packets, and I just have some questions for Scotty and perhaps Tom on clocking and how they're doing their clocking for their RF modules. And that's pretty much it. I just needed to understand how that's done so I could kind of figure out how to proceed.
Okay, very good. We'll get back to that. And last on the list, we have Dave in 1HAC. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. Not too much to report, but glad to be here, and certainly was inspired by Juha's talk on Thursday. I think we've got a lot to glean from what he was talking about. So back to net.
Well, we're ready for the regular net or regular discussion. I was under the impression, at least when we were working on the open HPSDR, that Vita was semi-open source. I think it's open source in one dimension. I think the in and output format and internal algorithms were not open source, is my understanding. Tom, do you have any clarity on that?
It's been a long time since I looked at Vita 49. It's probably just a little bit too long. My recollection is it's a protocol specification, so it identifies where the bytes fit, what the headers are, and it was a pretty simple, straightforward implementation. I don't know how they handled time marking in a precise way. And for all of us, I think time marking is probably one of the critical items.
Yep. I remember that when it was just coming out, the open HPSDR people were skeptical because they wanted everything to be open source. And this is like semi-open source. Although, don't the GNU radio people use it?
I don't, if it's in GNU radio, it's some out of tree module. I'm not aware of anything built into GNU Radio that handles it specifically. You typically build an adapter module for a particular radio that would have that as the interface.
Well, I would say, Dave, as far as the layout, I have it here in front of me if you want to see it. It is so simple that I was able to code up something that conforms to the whole thing in about 15 minutes in C. It's very straightforward.
I would think the good idea is if somebody wants to use Vita, they could use this kind of a module. And if they wanted to use something that they can't do, we'd just have a different kind of module.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I was saying we could have two modes of operation when the data engine is putting out spectrum data. We could have one that's fully Vita 49 compliant, and we can have one that's particular to the Tangerine, and which would support interleaving of subchannels. But the handling of timing is there's a place where you're allowed to put in fractional seconds on the clock, and it's 64 bits. So you could, and you can format those bits as you like. So you can put a lot of precision in there if you want. Now, for digital RF, I've been saying we need to have the data start right at exactly at the top of the second, because digital RF stores time only down to the second. So you need to start your data recording session. Boom. All channels start recording when you get that pulse per second and the clock rolls over.
And I've been looking at the Vita 49 spec here. I've got it up on my screen. It looks to me like it says here that the stream and class identifiers are optional. So it would seem like we could wait to the top of the second and start the packet there, because nothing says that we have to provide packets at any time. So we could make the rule that we only start on an integer second. And then we could, it seems to me, we could not have a stream identifier in the header, and it would be in our payload. And that would identify, you know, it would be our format that would be multiple streams, and it might still be Vita 49 compliant.
You have a point there. I mean, as long as they don't specify what goes into the data payload, we could say that part of our data payload is a description of the channels or something like that.
Right. And I think they don't describe what's in the payload. That's strictly up to us.
Well,
how we want to format it.
They say the data payload contains a continuous sequence of data samples encapsulated in a virtual container called an item packing field. And they do show how they anticipate you're going to lay it out. But do you have to conform to that? I don't know. I guess different manufacturers do different things. I mean, looking at what Flex does, they are about 95% compliant with Vita 49. I spotted one error thing this afternoon where they doesn't seem like they comply. There's a place where you're supposed to put in packet length, but Vita 49 says that packet length is supposed to be in 32-bit words. But if you look at what Flex actually puts in, it looks like that contains the number of bytes in the message rather than the number of 32-bit words. So,
yeah.
But as long as you document what you're doing.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, right.
You know, we're going to have documentation online for all of this. So.
But then obviously you want to pick a format that's going to be usable by the most widest variety of users as possible.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
And so I would think the key would be what applications do we want to support that require Vita 49 IO to those applications? Because if people are 90% compliant, there's going to be a lot of apps that end up not working.
Yeah.
I want to also mention that I wouldn't restrict it to only second boundaries. I think you may want to take packets faster than that.
We can't do it. We can't handle it in digital RF.
Yeah, the digital RF, I think it expects the file, it chunks the files on the boundary. And so Bill, you have to have the first packet exactly time aligned and then assure there's no gaps on subsequent packets.
Yeah, but that's the point is subsequent packets don't have to be aligned, just the first one, right?
Right. And presuming there's no gaps, then everything works.
Yeah. And if digital RF will detect if there are gaps and will automatically fill in the unknown data with NAN, not a number.
Okay. And it uses the sequence number to do that?
Oh, let's see. I believe so.
So how does it detect that there's a gap? It's probably the sequence numbers. That's the only thing, because the timestamp only occurs on 1 second boundaries, right?
Yeah. Yeah. To be able to tell you that definitively, I'd have to go back and look at the code, but there is a way that they have to detect that.
Okay. I'll just leave it in the notes and kind of keep a list of the questions here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to answer your questions, there's no restriction on the data rate by doing this. You can run the thing as fast as your equipment will run. You just have to start it at the top of a second when you have a data collection session.
I also wanted to mention and get Dan's comment on this. Lynn HPSDR is going through some revisions right now, and within the last week, there have been two projects going inside the software. I've been using the software for several years as my regular radio software, and one group is adding MIDI controls, which is kind of a legacy to John Melton's work, and the other part is they're adding SOAPy SDR access, and it seems like right now the SOAPy SDR is discovering, because I ran the software and it discovered my RTL, it discovered a Lime SDR, and it discovered my HPSDR boards. So that's going to be a nice feature, that it can be used for several different kinds of receivers or presumably transmitters as well.
Yeah, Dave, I've used SOAPy on a Raspberry Pi with an RTL stick. One of the were all of the discoveries that you did on your local network?
Yes, and okay. The thing was, the problem with Lynn HPSDR right now is I get a seg fault right after it tries to open a stream.
Okay, I had issues with SOAPy, and I talked with the author, and he made some changes, but it had very tight timing requirements on discovery.
Yes.
And a couple of other things. And if my network delay exceeded just a certain number of milliseconds, I would have discovery problems.
Yeah. But those were all local to my shack at okay. my own. They are connected with Ethernet, but just through a switch and then back to the other machine.
Okay. For example, I was trying to use Wi-Fi to link the Raspberry Pi into the local network, and I was getting enough delay through the Wi-Fi to have problems.
Yes, yes. Mines are all wired.
Okay.
So, Dave, I do have a script that will install Lynn HPSDR on Ubuntu on the regular main, the
right.
desktop version of Ubuntu. So I'll send that to you after the meeting.
Okay. Have you tried it recently, Dan? They've redone
yes.
the
I actually
the
ran
front
it
screen, too.
Yeah, I ran it today for about 15 minutes. Well, with my IQ2, and you're right, it does discover SOAPy. You have a choice in the menus as to what protocols you look for, and more specifically, what protocols you don't look for.
Yes.
So you can either do protocol 1, protocol 2, or SOAPy, or yeah. an individual one of the above.
Well, that indicates that we're going to have more general capability if we're using that with Tangerine as well.
Yeah, and I did have some issues, some seg fault issues with the previous version. I think that's cleaned up now. So if you would run the script, it will go out and get the latest version of
okay.
Lynn HPSDR. It automatically, because John actually puts the latest version in a special folder.
Oh,
and
okay.
it looks and picks out whatever that most recent version is.
I was using his GitHub.
Well, it actually does go to GitHub to do it, but... he has in his folder, he puts the latest version.
Okay.
So you can clone any version of it you want to clone. But if you don't really do it that way, if you don't download the repository and then clone, if you just clone, it picks up the latest one.
Okay. Yeah, I built his by hand each time, so I may not be following exactly the...
Yeah, it's simple to build. It's a very simple build. It takes maybe 5 minutes to do it with a script.
It's the wisdom file that takes a while.
Yes, that's right. The wisdom file actually takes longer than the compile.
Yes. Sorry. Dan, I
sent you something about... I ran your script on building Pi HBSDR, and it choked because it wanted an SRC directory, and I had to go back in. I had to go and create that and rerun it, and then it worked.
Yeah, that was a fault with the earliest versions that I released. I've since changed the topography and got rid of that problem. So there should be some new ones while they are available now. I just need to send them to Dave, and I'll copy you on it as normal.
So I did want to clarify. I was planning to put them on the Tangerine SDR.com website and not the OpenHBSDR website. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine with me, whatever you want to do with them. I really want to put them on the iQuad Labs website, and then I can keep them up to date that way.
Okay.
And then you can just link to the iQuad Labs website if you want.
I would prefer that if you're going to maintain them.
Yeah, why don't we do that? And then you can put them on wherever you want. I don't care.
Okay.
Okay, Jonathan, I think had some questions about time marking the samples from the receiver.
Yeah, Tom, I was wondering if your receiver ran on a separate clock or if it ran off of a clock from the FPGA.
Okay, the clocking scheme is that there's a separate clock, which is a very high quality clock, that comes from the GPS module that John Ackerman is working on. And it is routed as the input clock to the receiver. It's very low phase noise, very low jitter clock. And then the receiver takes that clock, uses it to clock the sample, the A to D converter, and to clock the samples out of the converter, and sends a copy of that clock and the samples over to the FPGA. And the FPGA uses that clock to extract the data from the samples.
Oh, okay. All right. Is there any timestamping going on with these samples that are coming from the A to D converter?
The A to D is unintelligent in that way. It just digitizes and sends samples. All the timestamping happens inside the FPGA. So it receives the clock from the receiver and the samples. It has to then look at the PPS time mark from the GPS receiver, and it uses those two pieces of information to timestamp the data packet.
Okay, that makes sense, because the way that the VLFRX tools works, the software that I was talking about last time, was normally the sound card is used as the A to D converter, and the clock of the sound card the samples are clocked according to the sound card's clock, and then they are assigned a timestamp from the host PC running NTPD. And those timestamps aren't completely accurate. So there is another program that uses the PPS signal from GPS, and it creates an offset for the timestamping values to correct them to GPS time. And I was wondering how something like that could be done, but it sounds like that you're pretty much doing it already. Would it be possible for the the FPGA to assign timestamps according to the GPS pulse per second signal in the same way as it's done on the HF receiver?
I would think the answer is yes, provided that you have a way to provide clock and to provide samples through the edge connector to the data engine. It would be best, I think, to have the FPGA do that marking. If you look at a lot of high precision timing data packet systems, they tend to do that in hardware, either an ASIC or an FPGA. It's extremely difficult to be very accurate timestamping if you have to do it in a software process. Or if the other issue you have to worry about is that the clock on a sound card is usually not very precise. And so you then have the issues of drift or frequency error, or maybe both, in the sound card, and then the issue of trying to figure out what the right timestamp is in software. And so the most reliable and accurate way is to let the FPGA take care of that for you.
Okay, all right, that makes sense, because when Paul was originally doing this, he experienced that sort of problem. He had a lot of frequency drift and a lot of frequency error. So how the pulse per second signal gets into the PC is that it's connected to the sound card, and he uses an algorithm search for either what he calls the phase center or the edge, or what he calls the centroid, if you were to run your timing pulse through a RC filter. And he's able to get very accurate time stamping with this method, because I asked him, well, what about if you use, say, like the DCD line of a serial port? And he said, that's just too much lag. So in this case, that's what he found best. And I wanted to implement something like that, where the time stamping would be done, but without the sound card, without all this, it would use the FPGA. So I think the best thing here is to think about how to use the GPSDO clock to clock the audio codec, and then clock in the samples to the FPGA, and then they'll be timestamped.
Okay.
So
right now the GPS module is sending a 122.88 megahertz clock over to the RF module. And that's the high accuracy, real clean clock. Your audio codec is probably going to require some different frequency than that. And I think John has a programmable synthesizer on his module, but it's something that we need to think about when we route clocks over to other receivers. So that's a good point, and I'll take a note.
We also have the ability to divide the clock down in the FPGA. Now, we don't want to divide it down and supply that clock if we have to. We can divide it down for timing purposes, for time stamping.
Yeah.
But you're probably going to need a lower speed clock than 122.88 to clock the hardware. And
yeah, a lot of those codecs have a 192 kilohertz clock rate. And so it may be that Jonathan's module will need a 192K clock or something in that range.
But so if the clock module doesn't generate that, then if we have to divide it in the FPGA, that's not going to be good, because we'd rather not do that inside the FPGA for jitter and phase noise reasons, right?
Yeah, it will be less clean. The upside, of course, is that the clock rate on the codec is a whole lot slower than the clock rate on the ADC. And so it may, I have to think about it, but it may not be as important to have quite the level of precision that we have on the HF module.
Yeah. And if we could generate directly on one of the synthesizers on the GPSDO, that would be cleaner than through the FPGA.
Yeah. So if you know, we could use one of those synthesizer channels and have it hardwired over, that would probably give a really good result for Jonathan's case.
Well, that's good, because we have four channels, and I was looking to where I was going to put the fourth channel. So we'll put that to the leaf interface. So one to the FPGA, one to each RF module, and one to the leaf interface. And that way, if we make the low frequency module a leaf board instead of an RF module, we'll have a very high accuracy clock from the GPSDO directly there. And then we can have the leaf module do a source synchronous design back to the FPGA, just like it does on your high speed board, only do it on the low speed board.
Yeah, that, in my experience, that gives the best results. Oh, good heavens, what did I just do?
Now, what are you talking about, a less precise clock to the codec? Are you talking an audio codec or?
Yeah.
Jonathan's looking at using an audio codec as a VLF LF receiver.
Right.
And so the sampling clock to the codec would ultimately determine the RF performance of the codec.
Yeah, no, you need to have a clean clock there. You can't scrimp on that.
Exactly right. We took great pains on that clock on the HF receiver, and that's why we're talking about, you know, rather than having the FPGA divide something down and supply the clock, which in our experience has not been a good approach. The GPSDO module has a very clean synthesizer on it.
Correct.
That can provide programmable clocks, and that would probably be a better approach.
Yeah, because both you want it time synchronous. You don't want it slipping in time to anything else that you're doing. Otherwise, you need sample rate conversion, which is a real pain. And plus, the jitter is actually quite critical on it, just as critical as on an RF codec.
Well, that's exactly right. That's why we think that synthesizer is the right place to generate a 192K or whatever the frequency is clock.
Yes, definitely do whatever you can to make a clean clock, because when you're digitizing down to the 24-bit level, jitter counts.
Mm-hmm. Well, it counts. It counts at a 16-bit level too.
Everywhere.
Yeah, it's amazing how few picoseconds of jitter just wipe out the sensitivity of the receiver.
Can I give an update on the magnetometer?
Please.
So I talked to Dave, and Holman has a working setup where Dave was able to help him get the code and the two ends of the magnetometer working. And then I understand that he took it out to Jenny Jump and installed it the middle of last week. And it seems to be working fine. I saw a report today that he was happy with the performance. Dave made some changes to the software so that it chunks the magnetometer data into one-day packets. And their timestamping is, it can be sampled at quite a bit higher rate, but it's the Raspberry Pi and Odroid are just using the N2 clock for the stamping right now. And so I have about 2 weeks of data collected that way, just to make sure it doesn't crash and things. And Holman's got at least a couple of days out at Jenny Jump. So we're getting there.
You're muted, Tom.
All right. Did Holman get a chance to look at the X, Y, and Z data coordinates to see if they, you know, if they match what he's seeing at Jenny Jump in terms of magnetic field levels?
He said they're in the general ballpark, but he hasn't been able to do any statistical analysis at this point.
Okay, so if they're in the general ballpark, that's, you know, kind of step one is, do the data make any sense at all? And then yeah. Step two would be, you know, how do we calibrate this, and how do we, you know, handle X, Y, Z, you know, non-orthogonality problems with the assembly and stuff like that. So it sounds like it's pretty good news.
Yeah. So does it make sense to go ahead and build quantity of these then? Dave?
I would assume that this is the one of Dave Witten's designs, right. And that seemed to work. I didn't see any, and the software seems to work very reliably. It's all written in straight C.
Using the simple one, or is he using the remote one?
I am using the simple one, and Homan's using the remote one.
And he's getting good results with the remote one, right?
Nathaniel, have you heard anything from Homan?
No, not recently, but it all sounds like good news. So, yes. Yeah, we should probably touch base with him.
Dave and Homan have been communicating regularly. Dave has been writing, here's how you do it scripts for Homan.
That's very good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Because Homan wasn't very familiar with Raspberry Pis.
Right. Yeah. That's very good news.
Yeah. And I at least can confirm that the same software works on an N2 fine.
That's excellent.
I have run it once on a NVIDIA board too, just to see. You do need a GPIO pin set to connect it.
Okay, if we've come to a stopping point on that discussion, there's something I wanted to run by the group while we have Nathaniel on board. this goes back to our discussion, I think it might have been, it was Wednesday or Thursday, I guess it was Thursday, about spectrum data collection. I thought about this quite a bit, and I've started to think that we have two probable use cases there. The use case that we originally talked about was where you have a ring buffer running, where you're collecting 24 hours of data, and when the super user or the scientist want a chunk of data, then we put out a data request to the users, and the systems will send data in between two bookends. But then we got to talking about another possible activity of continuous uploading, if we're going to collect hours of data at a time at a relatively low sample rate, it should be possible to send it up and send the spectrum data in real time or in near real time. So it seems to me that that's a kind of a different use case. So we could have a couple of different modes for the spectrum uploading to work. One could be a mode where the system is just basically copying data to the ring buffer and not transferring anything upline, and it's just waiting for a data request. But then when you get into this campaign where you're watching an eclipse and you want the data to be transferred quicker than that, we could have it where it collects the data and then pushes it upline continuously as fast as it can. And if it runs behind a little bit, you've got a certain amount of system capacity before you start filling up the hard drive. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have you'll have something running along here, filling up the disk, and something coming behind it, trying to catch up. And I don't know if we're going to have a situation where we run out of disk capacity. I guess it probably depends on making smart choices as far as what we recommend people to try and collect. How many channels of data do you want to try and collect?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're going to want to do this sooner rather than later. As soon as we can, we're going to want to run some trials where we tell people, have a few people running test systems and say, okay, turn this thing on, and then adjust your settings adjust your throttling settings.
Mm-hmm.
See how much we can actually push. So for example, if we want to have a given station, let's say a given station has an upload capacity of 1 megabit, could they run 4 channels? Well, they probably could for several hours, maybe 8 hours, and get through the data before you run out of space. So
also depends how wide those channels are too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the sample rate.
Right. Well, you're at baseband, how wide the channels are at baseband, right? So after you downconvert,
we've been talking like, about 4 kilosamples per second.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're doing, so if you're like doing the Eclipse experiment and you are monitoring 4 channels at 4 kilosamples per second, for WWV, that's a reasonable amount of data to push up in real time for many types of internet connections.
It depends on whether you want to let your upload monopolize your entire internet connection. I feel right. comfortable running mine at 1 megabit. Mm-hmm. And that is 2 channels of IQ data, 32-bit floating point. And it'll keep up with that because that's a little over 1 megabit of data per second. If you have more, I mean, the other thing is that for an Eclipse, it might be okay to tell the family, okay, guys, you're not watching Netflix today.
Right.
Today is Eclipse Day. Mm-hmm. We're going to devote our entire internet capacity to upload and then, mm-hmm. Then run 5 or 6 channels. And then, if you're dealing with 8 hours of data, it's not going to quite keep up with it, but it'll catch up. So I'm thinking that, like you were talking about a queuing system, mm-hmm. we can probably develop a way to collect all that data and then figure out how to queue it for uploading. Now you talked about using rsync. You had some great luck with that, and. Yeah. Let me say how I think it would work, and you correct me if I'm wrong. I think the way that rsync works is you have a directory that you do a synchronization on, and you start putting new files into it. The system will detect that those don't exist on the server yet, and it'll start pushing them. But as the server picks those files out of the inbox and puts them away, the system will detect that and will delete the files on the sending system. Is that how your system worked when you did this?
Yeah, something like that. I don't remember all of the exact details, but it was something where we knew that the file was transferred. And once we knew that the file was transferred, you could move it to another directory or delete it.
Yeah, there's a thing available for Unix systems called a watchdog, which will give you you can make it however you want, but you find out about it when certain things happen in a directory. So
right.
you can have it watch your inbox, and when new files come in, it'll trigger something to run along the lines of if this, then that, and mm-hmm. then it'll pick those files out, and you can configure rsync, at least I think you can, to delete the file on the sending system once it's safely been picked out of the inbox on the receiving system. So I think that might be a workable solution. And we'll just have to tell people who are helping us, that is our users, that we would like you to run in monitoring mode up until so many hours before the eclipse and then switch to continuous upload, something like that. And we'll obviously want to test that extensively before the day comes.
Right, right. I think one thing that's nice is Christina and the Case Western group, they've been doing these festival frequency measurement tests. And sometimes they do them for like eclipses, and sometimes they did one just because there was a WWV thing. I think having these periodic campaigns along the way are really good test cases. So as we are ready to test it out, I think, try to have them to do another one of these festival frequency measurement campaigns where, it's really more of a trial than it is necessarily for science. But I think that's a good way to do the testing. I know we've, from the tests that they've ran already, from the festival frequency experiments they've run already, they've learned a tremendous amount. And it's, really changed kind of the philosophy in terms of how much data or which data they collect, and it's
how they timestamp things or how what programs they're going to be using. So I think doing this is a really useful.
Yeah, and you know, we could have some real fun with this and do some real new stuff. Like, for example, you were talking about, you're reading the paper from Larissa where things in the mesosphere, troposphere can affect the ionosphere. Mm-hmm. Hey, we could do this. We could start watching the weather. And if there's a prediction that tomorrow there's going to be severe storms across the mid-belt of the country, okay, run a campaign. Maybe we'll see some ionospheric effects from a from tornadoes running through Kansas or something. I mean, it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, funny you should mention that. We just got a report from one of our local hams who was running a 2-meter skip probably off of a thunderstorm that just went through here last night. He was talking, I believe, to Alabama on 2 meters.
From where?
From New Hampshire.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah,
this I've done is that. Is it called T-skip now, for thunderstorm skip?
Yep. Well, I've known about that for years. I used to be a FM DXer. Every time we got a thunder front coming through, the deep south would open up.
Yeah. I've experienced that. I know what you're talking about.
I have a question. Are we envisioning that your server farm in Alabama is the main access? Are you thinking of any satellite servers to accommodate network outages?
Well, I don't know about for phase one. We definitely... Put it this way, if the National Science Foundation, if we really impress them and say, they say, hey, what you're doing, we want that, we want to expand that, then absolutely, I would think we would probably want to get funding and use Amazon Web Services, because they are truly 24/7.
Right. Well, I noticed the SDR Academy gave talks 2 weeks ago, and right at the beginning of their session, they had a local network outage that delayed the conference a bit. So you never know.
yeah, it's can true. Happen. It can happen.
Hey, Scotty, I don't know if we got a chance to get to you. Do you have any status updates on the data engine, FPGA, all that stuff?
Not really. I've been buried with trying to move out of our building. It's going to be done this week. And you all heard of the water pipe that broke. So it's been just really a disaster here. However, I did get the files from Intel, so I've got the characterizing data for the -6 part, so I'll be able to run that and see what's happening. I hate to use the term, my head's getting becoming above water, because I don't like the term water anymore. And,
isn't Arizona like mostly desert?
You know the irony of that. You know the irony.
Inside our building, it's not desert.
it's a lot of people will be jealous.
It's like we need a canoe inside our building is what the way it was. It was terrible. But we do have good news. Since it was a long weekend, these guys put about 50 fans and dehumidifiers inside the building, and they ran the temperature up. And when I came in this morning, it was 107 degrees inside the building.
Wow.
But the good news is that heat brings all the moisture out, and they said that they're not even going to have to tear any drywall out. They actually managed to suck all the moisture out of the drywall and out of the carpets and everything. So basically all we have to do now before the building closes is patch a couple holes in the drywall and repaint and fix the damage that the water directly made. So now I just got a note from my realtor that the buyer wants to move the date up now to the 13th. And I mean, this is like you can't just keep picking new days every time you want to move the closing date around. So it's scheduled for next Thursday. I think that's where it's going to stay. And we're trying to get the last vestiges of stuff out of the building, mostly recycling junk stuff that is, I don't care if it's really water damage, but it's like monitors that don't work anymore and old PC boards that are going to be recycled and things like that. That's mostly what's left. But once that's done, then I'm free, and I got one project left to work on, and that's Tangerine. So it's going to get progressing pretty fast here as soon as this gets, because there's no more business office once this is gone. Our offices are moving to home. So, and my office is set up already. So it's, I'm really looking forward to getting the albatross out from around my neck and getting back to doing some meaningful work instead of, it seems like all I've been doing is moving stuff, and it's hot here. It's was 112 yesterday, and it, I don't like moving in 112. I want to move in December, you know, not in July. But I'm stuck with it, so it'll be over soon.
Question, was it metal fatigue in the pipe?
No, it was a plastic pipe. The copper, the pipe in the building is metal, and they had some kind of Mickey Mouse. It looked like a piece of PVC with two end caps that were threaded in, and it was meant for a misting system. But unfortunately, the plumbers put the shutoff valve on the high pressure, on the low pressure side of the misting reducer, and it split along the bottom. The cap, the Schedule 40 cap, actually split and cracked open and let this shower of water out two different walls at the same time. And due to the amount of water that's there, we discovered it about 10 a.m. on a Monday morning, on field day, after field day weekend, right, after we've been gone. And we figure it must have burst early Monday morning, because otherwise there would have been way more water than there was, because it was coming out like an open pipe. So, I mean, 5 hours of that. But it put an inch of water over about 5,000 square feet of building. So if you could figure out how much water that is, that's a good amount. And then soaking up in the walls and all that. So it was, it was depressing to come in and see the mess that it made. So.
Scott, did those Intel files give you the ability to code and create a code for your Dash 6 part, or are they just like timing analysis files? And what do they do?
They allow me to select the Dash 6 part in the device selection menu. So then when I run the compile, it does all the timing for the Dash 6 part to analyze whether it's going to meet timing or not. So I'm really interested to see what it's going to do, because right now with the Dash 7 part, we don't meet timing with the memory. And then the other question I asked them, and this was a somewhat less than helpful answer, I asked them if we could do on-chip termination without doing the dynamic on-chip termination. In other words, just pick the low resolution resistors. And all they came back was the factory recommends that you use dynamic on-chip termination.
Yeah.
So they won't tell me whether it'll work or not.
So, Scotty, did you see the email from Jason Johnston?
Yes. And I do want to do that. Do a video update on what has he got, Ham Radio 2.0 on the website. And I also got an email from a guy in New Zealand, and he's looking for information on the clock module, because he has another project he wants to use the Tangerine for, I think, or at least the clock module. So I sent him on to John Ackerman for some specifics on what's happening with the clock module. He wants some data on the accuracy and things like that. So
that sounds good.
Did get him going, but yeah, this water has been consuming all of my time, and it's almost over now. They've taken all the fans out. It's the humidity's down to only 20% inside the building, which is about as low as it ever gets inside anyway. And they've run mold and asbestos tests. Believe it or not, it's a commercial building, so anytime you get any kind of water damage or any kind of movement of anything inside the walls, they have to test for asbestos, because that's they just have to. And the insurance company pays for that, so that's fine. But it's just a matter of whether I can get it into a shape where the new owner is going to say okay and accept it in the condition that was in before we started, before the water started. So anyway, I was asking Dave on the fit build of 50 of the magnetometers, because we want to go ahead and proceed with that. And that's about a 3-week job. And so we should be able to get boards by about the end of July and for Nathaniel. Okay. So we got to get together and talk a little bit about what we're going to do with all those boards.
Yes, definitely. So,
and I still haven't seen anything on the ARDC site on our grant, even though it was supposedly approved. Word I got was that it was approved, but there I don't see an official, you know, you're listed type. And it's been since the 12th of June. So it's been almost a month now. So I'm hoping maybe a month is a good time for it to, you know, maybe they only post them once a month or something. So, so hopefully we'll see.
And that's our vanity call sign for a University of Scranton worked. They seem to do vanity call signs once a month right now.
And so you heard nothing, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's your call sign?
July 1st, there it was.
All right. That's good. You just missed field day, though, huh?
Yeah, just missed field day.
Yeah, I was hoping that they would have put it in the database sooner, but they didn't. But now it's finally official.
So you'd been checking on the FCC database, and it wasn't there?
Mm-hmm. Until July 1st.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And when did you apply?
Maybe second week of June.
Oh, that's still pretty fast, a couple weeks then.
Yeah.
Again, the first of the month.
But we got the first, the sequential call sign almost immediately. Jonathan and I submitted an application to the ARRLBEC for a club call sign. And basically the next day we had one, KC3 Papa Juliet Oscar. But then about a week later, I applied for the vanity call sign Whiskey 3 Uniform Sierra Romeo. And I thought it would get granted almost like overnight, and they didn't grant it until July 1st.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's the time of working at home.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting on this insurance settlement, the insurance guys don't want to come out to the building and look at anything.
Huh.
Only if your building's unoccupied. And I'm going like, so you're going to make an insurance settlement without actually seeing anything? And they say, yeah, they're depending upon their contractors to make the assessment for them. So
somebody probably sent them photos.
Yeah, they've sent the guy took like 50 photos of the all of the. He has a meter that goes around. He goes around with to detect how high up in the wall the water is soaked, and so. But anyway, we only have like 10 more days to get the repairs made. So, and I don't want to give the buyer an excuse to delay or back out or anything. So I just want to get it done so that it's
good luck with that.
Back the way it was. Yeah. And if it's back the way it was, he can't argue, right? I mean, that's the idea, is if I don't put it back the way it was, even this is ironic because in the back, he's going to tear out all the walls. So it really, the carpet doesn't matter. He's trashing all of that. But if it's not the way it was when he made the offer, he can say, oh, no, you know, I want a discount now because I'm not getting the carpet. I'm not getting the walls the way they were, whatever he wants.
Yeah.
So I got to make it just like it was. The insurance company says that's what they'll do. So that's what we're going to do. But we have 10 days to do it.
Wow.
So, and actually, like I said, he wants to move it up 3 days. I'll do that gladly if we can get it done. If we can get the construction done. Anything to get it over with. I just want it over with.
Well, we are past our time. Just to let everybody know if you had something that you need to go to.
All right, 73s. We'll see everyone next week.
Yep.
I think I'm going to sign as well for tonight.
Good night. 73,
everyone.
73.
Well, good night. 73.
Yep.
Good night. Dan.
Hey, Dan, you got a second?
I wanted Dan, too.
Oh.
Yes, I have a second. Go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead, Dave, if you want to talk to him.
Well, I'm sure. I just wanted to ask about, so you're going to send me a script for Lynn HPSDR.
Yes, I'll send it to you. Okay. And also, Mike said he wanted a copy as well. And it should run. I actually ran it on that Desktopify hybrid Ubuntu 20.04 system, but it should run on Ubuntu,
so
whatever.
I'm running, I compiled it and got it running on, it's a 2-core, but Mint 20 computer.
Probably should, famous last words, but it probably should work.
It's like one of my kids' old computers.
Yeah.
That I just redid it with the I figured I would use that for experimenting because I don't really like to mess up my good computer very often.
What kind of processor is it?
It's an Intel.
So it's an I-86 type?
Yeah, I was probably not that far up.
So like a dual core cell?
Yeah, an I-86. But it's a Dell.
Oh, is a laptop?
But it's, huh?
It's a laptop? A
tower.
Oh, okay.
It's a Dell tower, but it's like 8 or 10 years old.
So maybe like a dual core Pentium 4, 2 gigahertz or something, right?
Yeah, my laptop's 8 core now.
Yeah. I want an i9. What is it, 10 cores or 12 cores?
Well, I'd like to try one of those Ryzen machines that have, you know, like 32 cores or 64 cores.
They have that many hardware cores?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like a workstation version.
But yes. I just look at how many watts the TDP is, because that's the real judge of how much computing gets done.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do that. I haven't made it very far in running more of your scripts because I don't have a pile of Raspberry Pis that I'm not using. So.
Well, I just use the same one over and over. All you have to do is change the SD card.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the beauty of the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, you need to get in touch with that guy at the DCC that has 25 of them.
That's right, yeah.
Hey, Scotty, I don't know when our next meeting is for Tapper, but I watched this SDR Academy, and it went pretty smooth, and they pre-recorded everybody. And if they...
Trapping guys?
Yeah. So they basically had two channels. So they had a team, a speaker would go to the one channel, record their talk, and then the team would have it. And then they had another channel, which was where everybody was, and they had hosts, and the host would introduce them. But then the speaker would be there for their talk and chatting while the talk was on, so they could answer questions.
But the talks were actually pre-recorded.
Pre-recorded.
Oh,
and that worked really slick.
So you could actually stop the speaker's talk and the speaker could give an explanation and then you could start it up again if you wanted to do it that way.
Well, what they did was the speaker was there. Some speakers didn't show up for that, but usually the speaker was there. They could play the talk and it was the allocated time. So you didn't have them running over.
Right, because you knew exactly how long. Right?
Yeah, and then at the end, the speaker would answer other questions and then they could continue to chat on the chat board if there were still questions when the next talk started.
Well, can they start the next talk over on the other channel?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Okay.
They had a way where they could handle it all and they did a really nice job. I was very impressed.
Could we do that? I mean, would we be able to have two channels like that?
I don't know. We have to talk. Yes. According to George, we can have what we want. It's just we pay for it for the month of September.
Right. And we have to administer it and make it work, too.
Yes.
So
we need essentially teams of people, and we're going to have to recruit some folks that know how to do it, including Nathaniel.
Well, I think Nathaniel would probably have some people who would be happy to volunteer, you know, like right. Christina and those people who have done it before.
Yes.
So,
but I saw that and I thought that was a good idea and I thought I'd pass it on. Shell was there. There was kind of an open HBSDR. I commented on Shell's talk. Melton was there. Lawrence Barker was there.
Too bad it had to be on field day weekend or I would have liked to see it,
but they're putting up the recording.
Are they up now?
They're doing one recording a day, they said, but they did get up. Lawrence Barker did a really nice job with a Xilinx FPGA for basically doing open HBSDR kind of stuff.
Okay. What is he using for hardware?
It was Vivada, something like that. Okay, I'll send you the link.
The development board then?
Yeah, it was a development board. He wanted to learn how to do it. And in Xilinx, they have pre-made little modules that do a FIR filter or a CIC filter or that kind of stuff. And then he just wires them together like GNU Radio.
Okay. And the Xilinx tool. He uses the Xilinx tool to do that. Yeah.
And so I thought that was pretty slick. But But it was an interesting talk.
I had a class on one of the Xilinx parts that came on a development board, and that was the theory, is you could take the blocks and you could place them. The problem was that nobody in the class ever even got the OS up and running on the, it was an SoC part. So,
well, and there was this SoC part for Lawrence.
So was it a Zinc or was it the, what do they call it? Xscale, I think is what the new one is.
It was I don't know. I'll have to
look. Well, I bet it was the new one because
it's the new one.
Yeah. But those, if you want to get one that has any kind of capacity, they're pretty pricey.
Yes.
So that was one of
the things. He said the one that he really liked to work on, he can't afford and he hasn't found it available anywhere.
Yeah. And I talked to the Aero guys because this was an Aero board that they had made, and they put like the second up from the smallest one on the Aero board. Right.
Right.
And you could buy the Aero board for, I think, $199 or $189, yeah, something like under $200. But it's not that useful with the second to the smallest one. So I queried the guys. I said, well, how about if you make one with one about two or three sizes bigger? And they said, well, yeah, we can do that. But then you start looking at the prices, and now you're talking about, you know, a $500, $600, $700 board for, yeah, something with that big a processor and FPGA on it. And I'm going like, you know, I guess we're just waiting for the price to stay the same and the processor, the number of LEs to get bigger and bigger.
That's right.
But I think realistically, I've gotten prices from our supplier on the Cyclone 5, the CVA-9, the same what's in the IQ-2.
Okay.
For the Mark II data engine. And I think that we can, it'll be more expensive, but it'll be the biggest non-SOC part that we can buy in the Cyclone 5 series. And it's gonna jack the price up about $150, maybe 200. So
well, there's
gonna more than double the price of the data engine to do that.
I think for the diehard development guys, you'll sell some.
Yeah. And the idea is to keep the core stuff off to the side and just chop off the Max 10 and put in the Cyclone 5 and then have a Mark II board that basically does everything the Mark I board does, but a lot more of it.
Yes.
So
that sounds good.
The way I've been kind of trying to do the design and the limited time I have, but I'm getting nervous now because September's coming up pretty fast.
Yes.
And even though we won't have an in-person conference, still got to have the board to show that you got one.
Yes.
So, and then we got a lot of FPGA code to do, which is way more fun than the hardware anyway. And, you know, we got a loader to do, and we have a whole bunch of stuff.
I keep sitting here thinking, oh my God, someday he's just going to ask me to do this ton of work all at once.
So are you going to be able to do that with your new class this fall?
Oh, the class is something I've taught before. I just show up and do my spiel, and the talks are all done. Isn't like after you talk for 25 years, it isn't like a new class. A new class is a lot of work.
So this is just, and you probably already have all of them recorded because of the last semester, right?
Yeah, some of them. And I'm team teaching it with another guy. So,
okay.
So we're splitting the lectures and stuff.
Because right now it's looking like there may be a whole lot of time available to do this, and I'm looking forward to it because it's
good.
I'd much rather work on the FPGA code than the hardware, but you got to have the hardware first.
Otherwise, right.
There's nothing to run it on.
So how is John doing on the clock? Is he making progress? I hardly ever hear about it.
I got to go crack the whip on him. He's not cracking the whip on me. So we got to get, after each other because I need that pinout hardened to put on the data engine. So we've got to commit to that somehow. And I'd like to see at least a preliminary design done so that we can lock the pinout down. Otherwise,
well, he has a lot of stuff with the website and this, figuring out.
He's been busy. But the thing is, like the idea that came up tonight was that the fourth clock going to the leaf, that just came out of the blue. And it's like, I don't know why that wasn't already in my head. But
well, yeah. And if he doesn't like that, he can wait for our LF unit if we get one.
Yeah, so plug it into an RF module socket, right? And then you get your own nice clock. But then he's going to have to deal with, well, he won't have to. I guess you can still
that. Nathan's going to build that.
No, but Jonathan's looking for that board.
And that's what I mean.
We'll build it for him, but we'll have to take the, we'll have to take the 192 megahertz clock, the 122.8 megahertz clock, but we won't have to because each slot has its own synthesizer. Right. So we'll be able to do it on that board. It's just that it might be cheaper on the Leaf board.
Yes.
So if it's a relatively low performance, then that.
I was very impressed with this talk from the Juha the Finnish guy that was in Norway.
Yes. Sounds like he can use an adaptation to also.
Yes.
So
I think there is some potential among academics for this board set.
Yeah. So I'd like to get the data engine out and the first RF module out so that then we can talk about new ones.
Yes.
And try to accommodate the new use cases. So I think it'll be very easy to accommodate new use cases once we get the base system working.
Yeah.
It's basically the same thing with each unit.
I did get one chapter of Tom's book, Typeset.
Oh, you did? Really?
Yeah.
How is it going? Is it a tough slog or is it?
Well, the first time figuring it all out, it's like doing the first board. Figuring out. Then the second one, I don't think it'll speed up as I go along, unless there's a lot of redrawing of stuff.
Did you start with chapter one?
I start with chapter one.
Well, you know it's going to get harder.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Bless you.
Sorry. Hi, Dan.
Nona's here, hiding behind the orange.
Yeah.
Hi, Nona.
So anyway, but I'm doing that, and then I'm trying to learn some new programming skills too in graphic interface.
I want to learn how to use Python because I'm going to have to test these magnetometers, or I'm going to have to cry for help for somebody to help me to do it. And I want to make sure that Dave's code will run both magnetometers because the difference is I have slightly different addresses than he does.
Well, so, that we can that can be reprogrammed.
Okay, and then the other thing is
he kind of flipped out on us, but I'm still getting along fine with Dave, so don't worry about it.
Okay, well, he's going to get a new board set, regardless of whether he's mad or not, and
I think that will help.
Yeah, and then I connected up the interrupt line also, and it supposedly works remotely. So if you don't want to use it, you can use it the same way you do now and not use it. Or if you want to use it, or if it doesn't work, then we can just not use it like we do now. But I found a way to connect it up. So it might be useful.
Yep.
It seemed like it would be if you wanted to set thresholds and wait for events to happen.
Yep.
Get an interrupt, hooked it up to a Raspberry Pi interrupt line. So
Dave has always thought that there would be a market for the magnetometer boards with just Raspberry Pis for people who don't want to go the whole shooting match.
Right. And this board will plug right onto a Pi. So you don't need any cables or any extra kits or anything like that, unless you want to do it remotely, in which case you just need two of them and then a bunch of cables.
Yes. Yep. So.